Welcome to another episode of Curtains at 8 on 91.3 WUKY's podcast. I'm Joshua Bear. This archival show originally aired June 27, 2002, with Nick interviewing Joanne Harris, author of the well-known book later made into date night movie, Chocolat. Nick and Joanne dive into her new book, Five Quarters of the Orange, the last of the Chocolat trilogy, which also included blackberry wine. Enjoy.
Hey, with any luck at all, you're here. Joanne?
I am, yes.
Okay, very good, very good. Let me start all my machinery here. Okay, we're rolling. Okay, joining us now via telephone from New York City, author of bestseller Chocolat and also the new publication from HarperCollins, Five Quarters of the Orange, Joanne Harris. Welcome to Curtains at 8.
Thank you. It's lovely to be here.
Good to have you here. I've got to tell you, first of all, the film Chocolat was one of my all-time favorites.
Oh, I'm very glad to hear that. I liked it enormously.
You seem to go with sort of culinary or cuisine sorts of titles.
Well, I have been recently, yes.
Yeah, recently. Okay, now, the first recorded information I have about your writing is about blackberry wine.
Oh, right. Oh, that's quite recent, in fact.
Quite recent. Well, what's your background, then? Bring me up to date.
Published two genre fiction books, which were kind of misdiagnosed as horror back in the old days. And then I wrote Chocolat. Blackberry Wine is the follow-up to it, and Five Quarters of the Orange is the kind of follow-up to that.
Okay. Set in French countryside. Now, from your accent, you do not sound French.
No, I don't, but I am half French, so maybe I sound half French.
Ah, see. Which half is French?
The left half.
I see. Okay. Five Quarters of the Orange. Tell us about it. First of all, it's been out for a while, but it's just now going to paperback, right?
That's right, yes. It's just come out in paperback in the States. And it is set during the war, during the German occupation of France, in a little village by the Loire. And it follows the fortunes of a widow and her three children during the occupation and the community in which they live.
Okay, now this is done in first person, right?
That's right, yes.
Okay, now, Chocolat was not done in first person, or was? I didn't read it. I saw the film, I'm sorry.
Yes, it was done in the first person from two angles. From the point of view of Vianne, who owned the chocolate shop, and also Renaud, who was the priest.
Who I'm in love with. I'm in love with her.
I know lots of people were, I'm afraid.
Yeah.
They all think I look like her, but sadly I don't, and they're terribly disappointed.
Is that right? Do you give out chocolate when you go around places?
I have actually given out chocolate in the past, yes, absolutely. People give chocolate to me nowadays, though, which is quite a nice diversion.
It's a nice turnaround, isn't
it? Yeah.
I presume that you love chocolate.
I do, although I did go off it after a while. I have got better now, though, fortunately.
I see. Okay, now tell me about Five Quarters of the Orange. Now, the way you set up a Chocolat, you had this tension going on between, I guess, people wanting to get involved with a Chocolat but thinking maybe they shouldn't, and this superb tension that mounted for a while. Now, do you do that with Five Quarters of the Orange?
Not quite in the same way, although there are a lot of tensions. This is a much darker novel, and it is really about a woman who is haunted by the past. And it's narrated in the first person, as you said, by my heroine when she is 9 years old during the war, during the occupation.
Mm-hmm.
Later on, when she is a woman in her mid-50s, having been married, divorced, having being widowed, having had children, and still unable to come to terms with her past. And then it's written as the same woman in much later life, when she is in her late 60s. And something happens to her, which means that she has to confront what happened.
Mm-hmm. Give us the setup, if you would, Joanne, in France during the war that leads to all of these corridors and turns and twists.
Well, obviously after the actual time of combat, when the soldiers went off to try to fight the Germans and failed to stop them. Now, the way my grandfather tells it, and he was there, after the soldiers had gone to war and come back, or at least some of them, they settled down in their home villages to find that really they were occupied by the Germans. This caused a bit of shock to my grandfather, on whom this story is loosely based, because the Germans had set up a barracks where he lived. He was a schoolmaster, and he lived on site at the school. And so there was a very uneasy moment of coexistence between the family and the Germans. And this was really what interested me about my grandfather's stories of the war, not particularly the combat, which sounded to me to be pretty much the same in every war, but this situation which lasted for some time.
Yeah, it was more than a moment.
Yes, well, years, in fact, where they had to live with the Germans and cooperate to a certain extent and survive in a situation they hated, but they had to live with. My grandfather found it harder than some because he was working in counter-espionage and he was passing messages to people in the resistance, and he was operating an illicit radio service, and he was doing all kinds of things right under the eyes of the Germans. And it must have been a tough time. And it got me to thinking about how that community reacted and what they were like. And from what he told me, the reactions weren't always good or positive or what you would expect.
Sounds to me like a very difficult moment to be able to survive and live through, which is, I guess, the premium. That's the goal.
Precisely.
And get along to some extent with the occupying forces.
Exactly.
How difficult could it be?
Well, it depends who you are and, of course, what you are willing to compromise.
Yeah, now, how many characters do you involve in this tense, long moment?
Well, really, I have principally a mother and her three children. There are other members of the community as well, but really it is a family story, and it's a story of division within the family and also division with the community in opposition to these Germans.
Okay, the mother and three children, boys, girls?
There is an older boy who is 12 or 13, and two daughters, the youngest of whom is 9. And she is really my heroine.
Mm-hmm. And how do each of these characters react to this, to the occupation itself, and then probably on a personal level at times with the German occupying forces?
Well, they are fascinated by the Germans. They know they're supposed to hate them, but they find them very interesting. They're not really terribly aware of what's going on around them. They're not aware of the politics of the war.
Yeah.
Because they're far too young, really, to think that this involves them in any way. They've lost their father, and so they know that the Germans are responsible for this, but they don't really correlate the loss of their father with the presence of these men who are around. And, of course, because the German barracks is forbidden and out of bounds to them, they find it incredibly fascinating, and they go to spy on the Germans all the time. And they make friends with one of them.
And this is off in the Loire Valley, which is not mainstream France anyway.
Well, it depends what you call mainstream France.
Well, I mean,
inland France.
Most of the political and warfare was going on not in the valley.
No, that's right. It is a rural area. It's still occupied, but not thickly occupied, because that there just weren't enough Germans to go around all the little communities, I suppose. But they do make friends with one special German. Just a moment, I've got somebody on my line.
Go ahead, that's fine.
I really don't want to.
Go right ahead and take it.
Thank you for calling. We are sorry to delay your call. Please stay on the line, and a representative will assist you in just a moment.
Ah, oh, the miracle of fiber optics.
Thank you for calling. We are sorry to delay your call. Please stay on the line, and a representative will assist you in just a moment.
Miraculous. Doopy doopy.
The woman wanting to give me chocolate.
She wanted to give you chocolate.
She did, actually.
Well, did you take it?
I did, actually, but I think she wanted to turn down my bed, but I said no. This is getting increasingly surreal.
Welcome to the States.
Absolutely.
Only in the States would somebody offer you chocolates and offer to turn down your bed.
That's right, yes. It doesn't happen to me every day.
Well, I wonder what else she wanted.
Well, I really don't know. I'm afraid I sent her away and put Do Not Disturb on the door.
You dispatched her, did you?
I did.
Okay. If you just now joined us, we're talking with Joanne Harris, who's the author of the best-selling book, Chocolat, which was made, of course, into the Academy Award-winning, now Academy Award-nominated film, and also it was shortlisted for the Whitbread Novel of the Year, I think, in the year 2000. Previous book, Blackberry Wine, and we're talking about, it's currently out, Five Quarters of the Orange. It's just now coming out in paperback edition, am I correct?
That's right, yes.
Okay. Tell me about the image of five quarters of the orange. How does the title relate to the story?
Well, the central metaphor, like the other two books that I wrote, which were loosely based on food, is the orange. And so it is food here as a metaphor for hatred and division within the family. So it's really the opposite of chocolat, where food was a metaphor for love.
Hmm.
Now, and the orange is the specific thing. The orange is the forbidden fruit.
Who forbids it? Who doesn't like it?
Well, this is a story of a widow with terrible problems, not the least of which are the fact that her three children are running wild with nobody to supervise them. And she has terrible headaches, which are brought on by the taste and the smell of oranges.
Oh, really?
And so it's something that she won't allow in the house.
Sort of migraines?
Terrible migraines, that's right, which are triggered by citrus fruits, and sometimes which bring phantom smells of oranges.
Hmm. So, how does this work? How do you use it? Is it like a bouncing ball from character to character?
Almost, yes. In fact, it's funny that you should say that, because one of my mother's stories about the war is that the first time she saw an orange when she was 8, she actually thought it was a ball.
Hmm.
And I managed to get that into my story.
How so?
Well, I just put it in as one of the children finds an orange. In fact, she steals it. And they are not particularly easy children to get on with.
Steals it from the Germans?
She steals it from a market stall.
Uh-huh.
And she has a plan in mind, because she doesn't get on terribly well with her mother. She has difficulties relating to her, and the mother is not a particularly sympathetic or warm character to her children. And so they feel quite relieved when she has to go and lie down with her migraines. And so this child, Framboise, decides that she is going to try and make this happen more often. And so she steals an orange and she hides it in the house where her mother can smell it.
Oh, but can't find it.
And in fact doesn't even know that it's there, because she has these phantom smells. And she just assumes that a migraine is coming, and indeed it does. And it gets her out of the way.
What a convenient tool that is.
Yes, indeed.
Okay, now let's see. We've got a mom who is debilitated by the scent of citrus, and we have three children, 13 to 9 in age, who are running amok, and we have Germans who have occupied. The Germans are probably some form of figure. I'm not sure what kind of figure. Not necessarily a militaristic figure toward the kids, but an authority figure.
Well, they're really aliens to the children. They're not supposed to go anywhere near them. They're objects of tremendous fear, but also of great curiosity. And they get friendly with one German, who seems very nice indeed, who mm-hmm. is young, who is attractive, who knows how to talk to children, who speaks their language, because he's just from the border between France and Germany. And so he's almost
Allemand,
a French one.
Yeah.
That's right. And so they get to like him, and they get to be friends with him. And he is very generous with them, and he gives them gifts. And they don't realize for a long time that these gifts are bribes, and that actually what they're doing is collaborating. They're giving him information which he is then using for his own purposes.
Collaborating in the sense of military intelligence collaboration.
Well, on a very, very small scale.
So he finds out from the kids what's going on, who's got the radio?
He does indeed, and he uses this to get money and to extract goods and to extract services and information from these people. Not to denounce them, because that wouldn't benefit him in any way, but merely to work for himself and to get things to send back to Germany.
Okay, now you spoke of your heroine as being a 9-year-old at one point in time, and then later returning to the Loire Valley as a 55, did you say, year
old? That's right.
What a difference in perception there must have been.
An enormous difference, because although she remembers what it's like to be 9, she's also had a whole lifetime to think about it and to think what it means, and she hasn't forgiven herself. She's very, very tough on herself.
So she realizes that she was collaborating inadvertently.
Not only she realizes that, but she realizes the terrible consequences of what she has done, which weren't immediately obvious at first. And it just gets worse and worse. She drags this terrible feeling of guilt behind her, because their innocent collaboration, and it is innocent to a certain extent, leads to something terrible happening. And it is the thing which splits up the family and has them thrown out of the community, and which really means that they don't see their mother anymore at all, and they're brought up separately by relatives.
What I get the feeling that this is sort of the reverse image of chocolat.
Oh, yes, it's very much the reverse image of chocolat. It's linked in some ways, but it is the darker side of chocolat.
I'm sitting here just thinking through the chocolat, people coming to grips with the better side, the eating chocolate and all of the goodies at the shop, and enjoying the good parts of life. And this is kind of just the very opposite.
Well, it's not about enjoying good parts in life, certainly, but it's not the very opposite exactly. It's about being brave enough to face up to your inner demons. And there's quite a lot of that in chocolat as well, because although chocolat is a very bright, happy tale in many ways, it has a lot of dark undercurrents. It's about finding out what lies beneath the surface of people. And those things can be good, they can be bad. People have secrets.
But in chocolat, it seemed that it was all for the good, to the good.
Well, in the film it was, but in the book
there we go. That was
the book the book has rather more darkness and edge than the film. And though I loved the film dearly, there were all kinds of things that it didn't pick up at all.
For example, besides this.
Well, there was the whole issue of the church, of course, which was neatly skirted in the film, but which was really quite an important issue in the book, because the character who is a mayor in the film is actually a priest in the Book of Chocolat. And he is a priest who, although not intrinsically bad, has a kind of power agenda. And he uses his beliefs to use that power over other people and to make them do what he wants.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
And he's a man with secrets. He's a man who's done bad things and who has rationalized them and who continues to rationalize them until there is a big showdown. And Five Quarters of the Orange is sort of the opposite of this, because this is a woman with secrets who eventually has to face up to them and to move forward. And as such, it's quite an optimistic story in spite of its darkness, because although she has done terrible things and has endured terrible things happening to her, she is still strong enough to get up afterwards and to make a life and to move forwards. And so this is about moving forwards in the face of terrible odds.
Sounds very interesting, very interesting. The Five Quarters of the orange being the metaphor that you use, the five quarters, the concept of five quarters, how does that figure in?
Well, that is from a very specific scene in the book, which when people get to it, they will see instantly.
You don't want to divulge it, do you,
Joanne? No, I don't. I think there are secrets in this orange, and it needs to be unpeeled at leisure.
Okay, each and every one for himself, right?
Absolutely.
Okay, funny. You were talking about the mayor being a priest in the book.
Yes.
The interesting thing was, when I was trying to recall exactly how the end turned on chocolat, I was imagining him as a minister.
Yes, but he is a minister. I mean, he is really a minister with a mayor's hat on. There's no two ways about that. I think that the filmmakers thought, and perhaps rightly, that people might be offended. And, of course, there's no such thing as a crooked priest, is there?
Not in the U.S., not nowadays. At least I haven't heard about it, anyway.
No, of course not.
Tell me a little bit about yourself, Joanne. You said you're half French, half English.
That's right, and my mother's French.
Grew up in?
I grew up in Yorkshire, in England.
Oh, that's where my mother's family's from.
Right.
Yeah.
My mother moved there 40 years ago from France.
Mm-hmm.
But I kept very strong links with my French family, because I found that my English family disapproved of my father having gone so far away to find a wife, and they always referred to her as that French woman, and we never had much to do with them. And so culturally, I am perhaps more French than I am English.
How much of your family and local community made it into the book, either on purpose or inadvertently?
Oh, quite a lot. Some of it inadvertently and some of it on purpose. I think it's inevitable that I'm going to write about the people that I know.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, nobody is 100% as they are in real life, but you do tend to borrow things. You borrow mannerisms, you borrow little anecdotes and events. You use your experience. It's not necessarily fact that you use, but it is the feelings that those facts give you.
Tell me a little bit about your early writings now, before Blackberry Wine.
Well, I experimented. In fact, Blackberry Wine came after Chocolat.
Oh, really?
I
didn't know that.
In my kind of food trilogy. Well, it got overlooked a bit, because it came out when the film came out, and people assumed that it was a reprint of something older, but it actually they actually follow sequentially in a kind of funny way. But before that, I had been reading a very large amount of science fiction and horror, and because I wasn't allowed to read this as a child, I kind of OD'd on it later on. And the first thing that I did was to write science fiction and horror. And it did manage to get into print.
What sorts of things did you write? I mean, give me some examples.
I had read a lot of gothic novels as an adolescent.
Mm-hmm.
And what struck me about the modern horror novel was that the genre has become very despised and very debased, whereas once it was an authentic literary genre. And I decided, being rather young and naive, that I would try and liven it up a bit and write something that was a literary horror novel.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, there's no such thing as a literary horror novel nowadays, and nobody knew what to do with it.
How did it turn out, in your estimation?
I was pleased with it at the time. It was a long time ago, and I hadn't really found my style, but I was terribly pleased when it came out. And although it didn't make enough money for me to give up my day job, I was terribly pleased to see it on the shelf.
What was your day job at that time?
I was a teacher.
Ah.
I continued to be a teacher for another 15 years after it was published.
What did you teach?
I taught French, principally in a boys' grammar school in Yorkshire,
mm-hmm.
called Leeds Grammar School,
mm-hmm.
which was a kind of boys' school for the damned. I enjoyed it enormously. I have hundreds of anecdotes about Leeds Grammar School, which will one day make it into a book when I am older and further away from litigation.
And characters, too, I'm sure.
Oh, yes, lots of those.
Oh, yeah. Tell me about the using the cuisine, the culinary, the tasty, the scent, all of these. Are you a chef, a closet chef? Have you trained as a chef?
I don't think I'm a chef. I'm a cook. No, I haven't trained at all. My mother's a superb cook. My grandmother was very good, too. I come from a sort of line of traditional French cooks, and so I paid attention to what my mother was doing. It's not really difficult. The kind of traditional French cookery that I write about isn't difficult to do. You just have to have a little bit of time and a bit of common sense. But I enjoy doing it. I think it's therapeutic. I don't think that people nowadays cook as often as they ought to, and it's a pity because it's great fun.
Well, it's going to be more and more difficult to do that here in the States. We stay so busy with so many different things that we do. It's much easier to go by some sort of convenience store and pick up something that's already packaged.
Well, sometimes it is and sometimes it isn't. I'm very busy too. I've visited 10 countries this year, and I'm going to visit another 4 more this summer, but I manage to do the cooking every day.
Even while you're traveling?
Well, when I'm traveling, usually I don't want to eat at all. Usually it's just airports and hotel rooms.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, nowadays I don't cook anything that takes more than 20 minutes to prepare.
Yeah, I suppose sauté is about as fast as you can go anyway.
Plenty of things that you can do.
Yeah, sounds good. Now, you're working on a new book, I'm sure.
I am, yes.
And what might it be titled?
Well,
something culinary?
No, it's not. I decided that I'd written a trilogy on food, and that was enough. I think people were starting to lay bets on what I was going to write about next and whether it was going to be toast or Marmite or sardines. And so I decided that, you know, there were other metaphors and other areas of sensual writing that I wanted to explore, and so I decided to go off and explore those for a while so that I wouldn't get too pigeonholed as that woman who writes about food.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wrote a book called Coastliners, which is actually out this September.
Oh, great. Which coastline do you refer to?
Oh, I use the French coastline. It's actually the coast of southern Brittany,
mm-hmm.
where my grandfather lived and where for a very long time he had a house on an island, on which I spent a long, long time as a child. It was all my summer holidays I would go there. And I would spend 7 or 8 weeks at a stretch on this island. And so it's a place I know very well, and I wanted to write about that.
Is this the kind of island that is basically isolation and beautiful, or was this sailing, a mariner experience?
Well, it was all of those. It was quite a large island. I have fictionalized it and made it smaller. But it was quite a different community to what there was on the coast. And the people who lived there were very independent, very isolationist,
mm-hmm.
very individual.
You've got characters in Chocolat that have come to life for me, and in Five Quarters of the Orange, I'm beginning to see them there. What do you have in Coastline character-wise? The same type of character involvement?
In a way, yes, there is a conflict. This is a small island on which there are two communities. One is struggling and the other one is doing well. The struggling one is in real danger because of the tides, and tidal erosion is beginning to wash away that part of the island, and so they are suffering. And the fish, the shoals of fish, which have been their traditional livelihood, have actually moved to the other side of the island, and so it's quite difficult to make a living. The prosperous community is doing better, has attracted tourism to a certain extent, has a hotel, and more importantly has a beach, which is the focus of all the activity and the trade of the island. And the smaller, more impoverished community, in a desperate attempt to redress the balance, formulate a plan to steal the beach.
I didn't know you could actually steal a beach.
Well, anything that can be moved can be stolen.
Mm-hmm.
And sand can be moved. Beaches can be moved. And in fact, they move all the time. Anybody who has lived on a coast or near an island will realize that actually they are moving all the time. Particularly sandy islands are constantly changing shape. In fact, the island on which my grandfather had a house had exactly the same thing happen to it. A beach disappeared in a matter of 2 months.
In 2 months' time.
And it took us a long time to realize why it had happened, but there was a very solid geographical reason for it. And it's one of the things that I've picked up on in Coastliners.
Well, it sounds like fun. Sounds like fun. Joanne Harris, author of Five Quarters of the Orange, which is just out now from HarperCollins in paperback. And, of course, Chocolat is still available at bookstores near you. Joanne Harris, it's been a delight talking with you. And I look forward to getting involved with Five Quarters of the Orange and also Coastline when it comes out.
Thank you very much.
Take care. Thanks for being a part of Curtains at 8.
That was Nick Lawrence and Joanne Harris, originally aired June 27, 2002, discussing Joanne's Five Quarters of the Orange, as well as Chocolat and Blackberry Wine. Thank you for listening to 91.3 WUKY's podcast. I'm Joshua Bear. Au revoir. Yeah.